Despite talks to bring about peace in Afghanistan, violence continues.
The general public in Afghanistan, obviously, they are fed up with this long war in their country.
Plus, what does the new Israel-Bahrain agreement mean for the region and Palestinians?
I think this is a strategic achievement. I don't think that we're seeing a massive move toward peace.
And what does 2021 hold in store for U.S.-North Korean relations? Today is Monday, September 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Taliban and Afghan government representatives began talks on Saturday, the next step in formalizing a peace agreement between the two groups. The head of Afghanistan's Peace Council, Abdullah Abdullah, said negotiators would discuss a reduction in violence. But the two sides continued to clash hours after the start of those discussions. VOA's Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad and is monitoring the talks. We spoke via WhatsApp.
Well, as we know that there was a formal ceremony in Doha, Qatar, on Saturday, which was also attended by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, both sides agreed to launch the process, this long-awaited peace dialogue. After that ceremony, the two negotiating teams held a meeting, which was not open to media, on Saturday, where they conducted some preliminary discussions. In the meantime, yes, we were hearing reports about more violence in Afghanistan. And on Sunday, there was another meeting. Like just a few hours ago, the Taliban spokesman confirmed that another meeting took place in Doha, and that in which basically they discussed rules and schedules for their forthcoming meetings, including one that will take place on Monday. The discussions were held in a very positive atmosphere, and that the two sides are determined to carry forward this peace process to negotiate a political settlement to the war in Afghanistan that has entered now in its 19th year.
The reduction in violence is something that, as you mentioned, Abdullah Abdullah and the Afghan government have been pursuing since the agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban was reached. But reduction in violence wasn't part of that U.S. agreement. With the uptick in violence in Afghanistan, what kind of impact could that have on talks with the Afghan government going forward?
Well, if we look at what Afghan officials have been saying, including President Ashraf Ghani, that they need the Taliban to reduce violence, that is one side of the picture. But we also know that the Taliban is a military force, and they have, over these two decades of war, totally relied on violence. From the outset, U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has been telling Afghans that the Taliban may not reduce and are not ready to reduce violence unless and until there is a mechanism that emerges out of these intra-Afghan negotiations that would give some sort of concessions to the Taliban where there is mutual confidence, and they talk about a reduction in violence.
Then, is the violence being used as a piece of leverage by the Taliban during these discussions?
Undoubtedly. They have been using this for years. And that is what actually, the kind of casualties that they have inflicted on Afghan security forces and even civilians have, prompted the United States to finally get down to this business of discussions with the Taliban so that this bloodshed could be prevented.
What are the people in Afghanistan saying after almost 20 years of war and these talks are finally underway? Are they fully behind the Afghan government in terms of trying to rectify a solution to end the fighting? or are they really reticent to enter into an agreement with the Taliban because of some of the issues in the past regarding rights issues, as well as the uptick in fighting?
The general public in Afghanistan, obviously, they are fed up with this long war in their country because it has displaced internally millions of people, and it has killed tens of thousands of civilians over the years. So they really want an end to this bloodshed. But the problem we are having is that while the Taliban is not so much popular, we have a serious issue with the Afghan government because there has been this rampant corruption in Afghan institutions and billions of dollars in U.S. assistance that have come to this country for the benefit of the people. Those benefits have not gotten down to ordinary Afghans, but to the pockets of some influential leaders and politicians in the country. So ordinary Afghans are as much fed up with the Afghan government as they are with the Taliban. So they have nowhere to go. But we have spoken to people on the street in Kabul. Everyone is really anxious to see some kind of a positive outcome from these discussions, so this war could go on and they could live a normal life and the country could be reconstructed.
Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad. Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump announced that Israel and Bahrain would establish diplomatic ties. It's the second Arab country to do so within a month. But on Sunday, Bahraini opposition groups have said that they rejected a decision by the Gulf state to normalize relations with Israel. And a leading Shiite cleric on Sunday was calling for the region's people to resist. Emily Hawthorne is a Middle East and North Africa analyst with Stratfor, a RAIN company. I asked her about the significance of the development via Skype.
I think this is a strategic achievement. I don't think that we're seeing a massive move toward peace in the Middle East, but I do think that it is a sort of reordering of the way in which relations between states in the Middle East are happening. So I think some of the big implications here are more and more states over time can recognize Israel in a different way, in a more pragmatic way, in a more normalized way. I think another implication is that the Palestinians are going to have to find a totally new path forward because they feel understandably very backed into a corner through this decision and the likelihood that more states are going to recognize formal ties with Israel. And I do think another implication to watch is I don't think it's a given that the Israelis pause annexation indefinitely.
What about those who are opposing normalization?
It will be really interesting to see if civil society in Bahrain, which is very active and very vocal, and certainly not all in agreement with the Bahraini government that made this decision to normalize ties with Israel, it will be very interesting to see how vocal they become. Their ability to speak freely has been limited in the wake of the Arab Spring, but still, it's undeniable that there will be many within Bahrain that are unhappy about this decision. And I think that that's the case throughout the Arab world.
I want to follow up on the pragmatic issues of the region that you mentioned. Is this more about realizing that Israel has been around for a significant period of time and what some people say is the threat of Iran versus Arab nations throwing all their support behind the Palestinians?
I think that those are aspects of it. The reality that the 1967 war is a long time ago at this point. I think there's some recognition of that. I think there is definitely some recognition of the shared threat that Iran poses. But I think more than anything, every state in the Arab world, just like every country around the world, has its own interests at heart. So, the UAE was looking at normalizing ties with Israel opens up possibilities for the UAE with respect to its defense procurement with the United States. And Bahrain as well is no doubt looking forward to new possibilities of ways to procure arms and weapon systems that they have been wanting for a very long time. And that's just one facet of this. But I think Bahrain is looking to see what they can get that will better them economically and security-wise. And same for the United Arab Emirates. And I think that that is what a lot of this comes down to.
You mentioned that Palestinians may have to find a new tack to move forward. What options really are left open to them at this point?
There are really, there's a lot of sort of divisions between Palestinian politicians and political groups. And I think that you're already seeing this recognition that they have to group together and sort of cohere around a common vision if they want to really move forward in a way that combats Israel's drive toward annexation.
So is annexation the primary thing that Palestinians are more concerned about versus, you know, attaining statehood or some sort of two-state solution?
I think that they are very linked together because many of the sort of Palestinians that I've spoken with view continued Israeli annexation of West Bank territory just a sort of direct move toward a one-state solution that completely erodes their rights or ability to sort of have their own state or even their own rights within an Israeli state. But I do think that we're at a very critical moment in Palestinian politics where you're going to see some generational shifts in the leadership of some of the major parties, especially the Fatah party that sort of leads the Palestinian Authority. And I'm very curious if we do see a more pragmatic tack moving forward. But also to do that, they're going to want to make sure that they have ears in Washington that are listening to them, and they don't feel like they have that right now with this administration.
That was Emily Hawthorne, a Middle East and North African analyst with the RAIN Company's Stratfor Group in Austin, Texas. Also in the region, Libyan officials say that the interim government of eastern Libya has resigned amid street protests that erupted across the divided country over dire living conditions. Hundreds of young Libyans flooded the streets of Benghazi and other eastern cities in the past couple of days in a spontaneous outburst of anger over the area's crippling electricity shortages. The European Union and China will hold talks on Monday with hopes of striking a trade and investment deal by the year's end. Several issues pose potential hurdles, from human rights and climate concerns to the outcome of November's U.S. election. Lisa Bryant has that story.
Expectations for the summit have already been notched down. It was supposed to be a face-to-face meeting in Leipzig, Germany, between Chinese President Xi Jinping and the 27 European Union leaders. Because of coronavirus concerns, it has now turned into virtual, downsized talks between just Xi, top EU officials, and Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, which holds the bloc's rotating presidency. The two sides still hope to reach an agreement this year on a deal granting greater investment in and access to each other's markets. But as European Council President Charles Michel pointed out during previous EU-China talks in June, there are key points the two global powers do not agree on. He noted European concerns on issues such as human rights, climate change, and cyber attacks. Indeed, Reuters news agency suggested Monday's talks may result only in a modest agreement for now on protecting regional food designations on products such as Irish whiskey and Chinese bean paste.
What's at stake here is that the EU-China relationship is not in really fantastic shape at the moment.
Janka Ertl is director of the Asia program at the European Council on Foreign Relations Policy Institute.
The situation in Hong Kong, the situation in Xinjiang, plus the economic situation that hasn't improved over the last few years, plus COVID, has really created a lot of concern in Europe about the future of the relationship with China.
She's referring to European concerns about China's treatment of minority Uyghurs and its policies toward Hong Kong, including the controversial new national security law. On the economic side, Europe wants greater market access, intellectual property rights protection, and climate change commitments from Beijing. U.S.-Chinese tensions also form part of the backdrop for the talks. Observers say China, in response, seeks a closer relationship with the EU, while Europe is wary of becoming a battleground for the American and Chinese governments. Ertel says the U.S. presidential election, pitting former Vice President Joe Biden against President Donald Trump, will influence the next steps for Beijing and Brussels.
Under a Trump presidency, the outlook for transatlantic cooperation and coordination on China is not great because of the way that the Trump administration has so far dealt with its allies.
By contrast, she says, Brussels and Washington may cooperate more closely in responding to China under a Biden presidency. For now, experts say EU member states are divided over how to deal with China, whether to adopt a tougher or softer approach moving forward. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
With tensions between NATO allies Greece and Turkey rising, Greece has announced plans to purchase a grab bag of new warplanes, frigates, helicopters, and weapons systems. Greece's defense shopping spree comes amid a new diplomatic scramble with U.S. Secretary Mike Pompeo visiting Cyprus to ease an energy standoff in the eastern Mediterranean. Anthony Karasava has the details.
Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis announced the defense upgrade, saying it stemmed from the need to offset what he called Turkey's destabilizing moves in the region. Along with its long-standing air and sea claims in the Aegean, Ankara is now torpedoing peace in the eastern Mediterranean, Mitsotakis said. Turkey is threatening Southeast Europe and is undermining security at a crucial crossroads between East and West, he said. Greece and Turkey are locked in an increasingly tense and dangerous standoff in the Aegean Sea and Eastern Mediterranean over hydrocarbon drilling rights and delineation of the maritime boundaries. In a speech at a trade fair, Mitsotakis said Greece would obtain 18 new warplanes from France to replace its aging fleet of Mirage 2000 fighters. The shopping list will also include four new Navy helicopters and an equal number of frigates. Existing battleships will also be refurbished. Details of the deals were not announced, but it is not the first instance this year in which Greece has shown an interest in substantially upgrading its defenses. Greece and the U.S. are already in talks for the procurement of at least 24 fifth-generation F-35 warplanes for $3 billion. Having finalized its intent, the new acquisitions, experts say, would give Athens a significant qualitative edge in its air defense against Turkey, which is facing problems in procuring new aircraft and upgrading its existing fleet. The United States suspended Turkey from the F-35 fighter program after it moved to acquire advanced Russian S-400 air defense missile systems last year. Mitsotakis' announcement comes amid a new diplomatic effort in the region by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to convince Greece and Turkey to back off from their month-long standoff in the eastern Mediterranean. After talks with Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis and other officials, Pompeo said the United States remains deeply concerned by Turkey's continuing operations, surveying for natural resources in areas over which Greece and Cyprus both assert jurisdiction in the eastern Mediterranean. Pompeo added that countries in the region need to resolve disagreements, including on security and energy, resource and maritime issues, diplomatically and peacefully. Increased military tensions help no one but adversaries who would like to see division in the transatlantic unity. Pompeo's visit to Cyprus comes hot on the heels of a similar visit by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Greece has refused to engage in negotiations with Turkey until it stops searching for eastern Mediterranean gas reserves. However, Sunday, just hours after Pompeo shuttled to Cyprus for high-level talks, hopes of a breakthrough seemed to emerge. Turkey called its top research vessel back to base, leaving an opening for a potential start to crucial negotiations. I'm Dikara Sabar for VOA News, Athens.
And coming up later...
It is always a topic that is always moving, always changing, always challenging us to really put our thinking caps on and think boldly when it comes to this issue, because it is not going away.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. There are almost 29 million COVID-19 infections around the world. The United States remains the country with the most infections, with more than 6.4 million cases. India has eclipsed Brazil to take over the second spot with 4.7 million cases, while Brazil has 4.3 million cases. The British-Swedish pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca has resumed its experimental COVID-19 vaccine trials after getting permission from safety monitors, according to the company on Saturday. VOA has extended coverage of the pandemic on our website. Nations accused of violating their citizens' rights and freedoms will come under intense scrutiny by the 47-member UN Human Rights Council during its upcoming three-week session. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on expected highlights of the meeting, which opens up on Monday.
As its first order of business, the Council is expected to consider a request by member countries to hold an urgent debate on the human rights situation in Belarus. The country has been in turmoil following the alleged rigging of the August 9th presidential election. The alleged extrajudicial killings of thousands of people caught up in Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs also will be a top issue. Beyond that, several perennial violators will come under the glare of the human rights spotlight. Reports detailing summary executions, torture, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, sexual assault, and other violations in countries such as Syria, Myanmar, Venezuela, South Sudan, Libya, Iran, and Cambodia will come under review. In addition, some investigative mandates may come to an end. For example, the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in Burundi, established 4 years ago, will present its final report later this month. Human Rights Watch's Geneva director, John Fisher, says it is important the Commission's mandate be maintained. He says little has changed on the ground despite the coming into power of Burundi and President Evariste Ndayishimiye following the death of long-serving President Pierre Nkurunziza.
We are also very concerned that the president has made critical remarks about civil society, has signaled that they should not be the mouthpiece of foreign powers or involved in selling secrets to or unveiling secrets to foreigners, that they have tended to limit themselves to criticism, etc.
Fisher says he is concerned that several people responsible for violations under Nkurunziza's rule remain in the new government. Human rights activists are pressing for accountability for the actions of so-called untouchable countries at this session. These are countries deemed to be too powerful to be put in the dock at the Council. A global coalition of 321 civil society groups from 60 countries is calling for China to face greater scrutiny for its alleged systemic and serious human rights violations. Activists expect Russia to come under heightened scrutiny because of its alleged poisoning of opposition figure Alexei Navalny with a deadly Soviet-era nerve agent. Fisher says conditions in Saudi Arabia demand greater scrutiny.
The number of the women's human rights defenders and other government critics remain held incommunicado in detention that detailed situations of prison overcrowding, which of course exacerbated the health crisis, particularly during the COVID pandemic, denial of access to healthcare, deaths of detainees in custody in suspicious circumstances.
Fisher says all detainees should be released and the Council should press for prison reforms and keep Saudi Arabia under its human rights lens. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
At least 100,000 Belarusian protesters took to the streets of Minsk Sunday in one of the biggest demonstrations yet against President Alexander Lukashenko after he claimed a landslide victory in an election his opponents say was rigged. Key opposition figures have since either been jailed or fled the country. Lukashenko denies the election was rigged and has said foreign powers are behind the protests. Police say they detained about 250 people in Minsk. Crews resumed searching for the dead on Sunday among blackened ruins left by massive wildfires raging in three western U.S. states, where millions of acres have burned in the weeks, and a mass fatality incident is feared in Oregon. The blitz of wildfires across Oregon, California, and Washington have destroyed thousands of homes and a dozen of small towns this summer, scorching a landscape the size of the state of New Jersey and killing at least 26. Last week, the Center for the National Interest, a nonpartisan public policy center here in Washington, held an online seminar about North Korea. Among the topics discussed were the challenges facing U.S.-North Korean relations following the upcoming 2020 presidential election. Bill Richardson is not only a former governor of New Mexico and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, but he also participated in negotiations with North Korea to release detainees. He says Pyongyang may be waiting to see who will win the next presidential election before engaging again with Washington. But regardless of who wins, Richardson says presidential summits should end.
We should bring back the six-party talks. I think not in replacement of bilateral talks, but as a supplement to bilateral talks.
He adds that having a clear objective in future talks is essential.
I think we also need to be realistic about what the North Koreans are willing to put on the table and see if that is satisfactory to us. They're not going to want to denuclearize.
Lieutenant General Wallace Gregson, who serves as the Center for the National Interest Senior Director of China in the Pacific Program, expanded on Richardson's thoughts, saying that there were many reasons to pursue nuclear disarmament with North Korea, especially if it's done in company with allies and international partners. But
we have a pattern. One of the many patterns we've set with North Korea over the years is we set a goal that's, frankly, in my mind, impossible: complete nuclear disarmament of North Korea. And then we shut off all contact after we're disappointed by North Korea, and we go back and reset. And an administration or two later, we go through the same cycle again.
Regardless of what direction future talks take, General Gregson says the current framework for discussion will not achieve nuclear disarmament, in part because their arms exporting businesses have been successful, as well as their global criminal network.
Nuclear weapons are not the only North Korean weapon of mass destruction. If we're going to talk about disarmament, we got to roll them all in there.
This highlights a key challenge, says Jessica Lee at the Quincy Institute in Washington.
North Korea is arguably among the most challenging and difficult foreign policy issue that's facing us, here in Washington.
With tensions between the United States and China on the rise, and polls showing that Americans are growing tired of foreign wars and want leaders to place more attention on domestic concerns, Lee says,
whoever prevails in January, the American president will need policies that improve lives here at home rather than needlessly escalate tension in places Americans don't want to be in. Unfortunately, many in Washington continue to underestimate the North Korea issue.
And that means being aware of the changing conditions on the peninsula, especially where North Korea is concerned, says Daryl Press, a professor at Dartmouth College, where his teaching and research focuses on U.S. national security policy. Press asserts that while the North Korean army may be eroded past the point of irreversible decline, the consequences for the United States engaging in conflict on the peninsula is greater than ever before.
Why is this? North Korea developed the ability to deliver primitive nuclear weapons in its region. We're not quite there yet, but we're knocking at the door, which is the ability of North Korea to reliably deliver in peace or in war atomic or thermonuclear weapons against American cities.
He adds that potential talks with North Korea may also take into consideration Washington's changing interests.
Today, America's primary interest in East Asia has focused more narrowly. The primary interest has to do with managing the rise of China.
Regardless of who wins the 2020 U.S. presidential election, the Center for the National Interest Korean Studies Director, Harry Kaziana, says with North Korea, one thing is clear.
It is always a topic that is always moving, always changing, always challenging us to really put our thinking caps on and think boldly when it comes to this issue, because it is not going away.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Stay healthy, stay safe, and have a great day.